Thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and investing news source. Welcome back, Peter Schiff.
Hey, Chris, how are you?
Good. We're hearing talk that maybe U.S. equities have reached a pinnacle, topped out after one of the most stunning rallies in years, early part of 2019. What's going on?
Well, I think so. I mean, I said on my podcast at the beginning of May, remember the first day of May, I did a podcast, and that was a day where the Fed came out and disappointed the markets and wasn't as dovish as the markets had been expecting. And so I thought that was a key moment. The market sold off a little, but at that time I said, I think the bear market rally is over. It actually, the bear market rally was more substantial than I thought. I called the rally as soon as the Fed did the reversal on monetary policy. I called the rally. In fact, I called the rally before the Fed reversed because I knew the Fed was going to reverse. And I said that when the Fed reversed and took the rate hikes off the table, that the markets would rally. I just did not think the rally would be as strong because some of the indexes actually made new highs. And normally a bear market rally can't do that. But this one did. I mean, it was a very vicious bear market rally. But it ended, I think, on May 1st. And then I reiterated that call the following week on a couple of podcasts when Donald Trump basically pulled the rug out from under the markets by escalating the trade war, when he put out those tweets that he was about to hit more Chinese products with 25% tariffs, the market started to go down. In fact, the Dow is down maybe 6% now since the beginning of May. So I guess a lot of people probably wish they sold in May and went away. But they didn't understand how big the problem is, nor do they understand. I think I said initially on my podcast, after Trump's tweets, when the Dow was down about 600 points at one day, it didn't close down 600, it closed down maybe 400 or something, but it was down 600. People thought it was an overreaction. I thought that the markets were underreacting, that if people really understood how bad the situation was, we would be down 6,000 points, not 600. You just look back, I mean, historically, the markets have been pretty strong in the beginning of the year. And seasonally, the markets do have a tendency to sell off in the summertime. Generally, the time to come back has been, October timeframe. You know, sometimes we get some big sell-offs, September, October, and then you usually get a year-end rally. But I think the summer is usually, historically, not always, of course, it doesn't always work. Sometimes, the markets keep going up. And selling in May hasn't worked that well over the last many years because this is the biggest bull market we've ever had as far as duration. And so I guess, people who were expecting it to die easily were disappointed. I mean, this market has been hard to kill. I do think it's dead, and I think the bear market is alive and well. People thought it was over when, the markets rallied, but, that's what bear market rallies do. They convince people that it's not a bear market.
Okay, so you're convinced then that we're looking at something similar. Let's go back 10 years, 2008, 2009. As the market was topping around 2007, it took a good, wouldn't you agree, 18 months before we had the brutal sell-off. Do you see more sideways, sine wave action until that occurs?
Well, I think the market's headed lower. I mean, maybe the announcement of some kind of a trade deal could cause a rally, but at this point, I wouldn't think yet. I don't think the market's low enough. But I think that we're going to go back down to where we stopped last time, down approximately 20% from the highs in the Dow and the S&P. That is when the Fed did the about face. And so the next thing the Fed is going to do is actually cut rates. So they haven't done that yet. All they've done is take the rate hikes off the table, but they haven't cut rates. And that's going to be their next move, most likely. That and potentially, ending the quantitative tightening program. But of course, it will be followed by the return to quantitative easing. All that is coming. The only question mark is, will it come incrementally or all at once? And, there's no way to know, but even if they start incrementally, that won't produce a large enough rally. And of course, the economy is heading into recession. I mean, everybody, you know, bought into the head fake of that 3.2% GDP number that we got for Q1, which surprised everybody. But if you really look at that number, there were a lot of one-off effects that really need to be, you know, pulled out to get a better handle on what was going on in the first quarter. It was not an economy growing at 3.2%, much less than that. And I think we're going to see a big give back in the second quarter. And so when you average the first half of the year, you know, we can end up, you know, with an average rate of below 2%, and, you know, we're going down from there.
If we backtrack to, you know, the beginning of this, the last QE, you know, operation, we started off with about $500 million on the Fed's balance sheet, approximately. We haven't wrung that excess almost $3 trillion. We're in an unusual position here that we've never really seen in history.
The Fed for years was lying that they would return the balance sheet to the levels it was at before the crisis. And that, as you said, was under $1 trillion. Well, you know, they were at $4.5 trillion. Now we're just below $4 trillion. We're 3.9 something. And they're almost done with the wind down. And so they didn't get anywhere near where they started. I mean, the balance sheet was, you know, barely declined, you know, maybe 10, 15% or whatever it is, 20% decline max. And then they're going to wrap it up again, and they're going to go well above $4.5 trillion. I mean, they're going to take the balance sheet, you know, to infinity and beyond.
Because I think that's implied, isn't it? When you don't return to your starting point, it's almost de facto baked into the cake, eventual runaway prices.
This is debt monetization. This is exactly what Ben Bernanke denied the Fed was doing. He lied to Congress, and I pointed that lie out at the time that he said it. And the markets still haven't called the Fed out on this. And the idea that this is not a permanent increase in the size of the balance sheet, that means the Federal Reserve is monetizing U.S. government debt. It is taking the debt and turning it into money. It is buying up the bonds and printing Federal Reserve notes that are never going to be withdrawn from circulation. This is how banana republics finance government. This is exactly what we told the markets we weren't going to do, but this is exactly what we're doing. And this is a, you know, a disastrous course, which means endless money printing, and it also means that there's no way the Fed doesn't have a mechanism for draining liquidity. You know, as inflation starts to really accelerate, they can't do anything about it. Can't sell these bonds that are permanently part of their portfolio.
We need to qualify, don't we, when we say they don't have a mechanism for draining liquidity. What I think you mean is they're faulty. They don't have the power that they had in the past to divest those securities.
If they had the power to do it, they would have done it. They can't. They had to stop it. I mean, yes, in theory, they could sell the treasuries to buy back the dollars, the Federal Reserve notes, but they won't do it, because the economy would implode. The banks would fail. I mean, the government would be forced to default on its debt. I mean, this is the box that the Federal Reserve has, you know, put us into by subsidizing government, by making it possible for government to get bigger and bigger and bigger and to fund ever-increasing deficits. They've put us at the situation where the currency itself is in jeopardy, because there is now so much debt that the choices are ominous: either a complete collapse of this entire bubble with massive losses on a scale much greater than anything seen in 2008, with nobody getting bailed out, or they destroy the currency and, you know, we're like Argentina. And, you know, the dollar just becomes monopoly money. That's where we're at. I mean, there is no graceful way out of this. We have two potential disasters. One is just worse than the other.
I'm glad you brought up Argentina. According to our guest last week, Professor Kotlikoff, Argentina had one of the, if not the highest at one point, highest per capita standards of living before they devalued and destroyed their currency. What do you say to our listeners who are scratching their heads? Everything Peter's saying is right on paper. But, you know, the U.S. still is the strongest manufacturing nation, even bigger than Europe, as far as that's concerned, and only China is coming close to rivaling its manufacturing power.
You know, we have the biggest trade deficit in manufactured goods. So, we're a large country, and we need to manufacture something. But the problem is we don't manufacture nearly enough. And a lot of the stuff that we do count as being manufactured here is really just assembled here. because we import a lot of the components. I use the example of Callaway golf clubs, which we manufacture Callaway golf clubs in the United States. Well, we import the shaft, we import the grip, and we import the head. So all we do here is, you know, attach them to each other. So could we really make that golf club without importing all that stuff just because it counts as being made here? So a lot of the numbers overestimate how much we're actually manufacturing versus what we're simply assembling. We don't have the savings. We don't make the capital investments. We have built this country on debt and consumption and imports. And the reason that, you know, people think that our economy is strong is because we're able to continue to go deeper into debt to spend more borrowed money. And so, you know, if you have somebody who's out there and he's spending on credit cards and living it up and driving a flashy car and eating in restaurants and travel around, you may not know that this person is broke, that they have no job and they're just going deeper into debt. But if they could keep on getting another credit card and increasing their limits, they can fool you for longer. And that's what's happening with America. When people look at the U.S. economy and they think it's so strong, it's simply because we're able to continue to borrow money that we have no ability to repay, and people still lend it to us. So that you can't confuse that. Just because we keep on shopping, it doesn't mean we have a strong economy. It just means the bubble is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but eventually it's going to pop. And by the time it does, you know, obviously by then it's too late to do anything about it.
I mean, I see a lot of similarities between asset bubbles today and the year 2000. Can you tell people your thoughts on the likelihood that now that the Fed funds futures at the Chicago Merck are predicting a rate cut cycle as soon as December of this year or January next year? Do you see any chance that this reaction in U.S. equities might lead to higher highs, an extended bull rally, as Fed officials and policymakers try to prop up in the economy?
Obviously, it's possible that the market can make new highs, and we're not even that far from the highs, maybe 5-6% or whatever we are. So it's certainly possible. But I don't think that the Fed is going to be able to reflate the bubble by going back to the QE policies. I mean, first of all, they're going to have to go to zero on rates. It's not like, you know, a little bit of, you know, cut. But even going to zero, it's only 200 basis points or so of cuts. So that's not nearly as much as they used to reflate the last bubble. And generally, each time a bubble pops, they need a much bigger one to replace it. So they're not going to be able to create a bigger bubble with just 200 basis points of rate cuts. So where they're going to have to put in the extra oomph is going to be in the size of the QE program, which instead of being $85 billion a month, which is what we had in QE3, we could end up with $200 or $300 billion a month in money printing. But there also may be a different mechanism where that money may not be entering the economy through the stock market the way it did before. I mean, they may be just giving it directly to individuals in government programs. Who knows how this quantitative easing is going to filter through in the economy. But I do think it's going to be very inflationary, not for asset prices next time, but for consumer prices. You know, the dollar is at an all-time high, really, or close to it, the trade-weighted dollar index. It was at an all-time low when the Fed launched QE1. So when the Fed started QE4, the dollar was very low and it rose, and that helped keep prices in check. But this time the dollar is very high, and I think when they launch QE, it's going to tank. And if you look at the trajectory of consumer prices and even the way the government measures them, we have been creeping higher and higher and higher, and I think that's going to accelerate. And that's going to rain on this parade when you really start to see stagflation. I mean, this is not the environment that we're used to. Everybody is used to when the economy weakens, then inflation pulls back and bonds rally and there's safety in bonds, and that acts as a stabilizer to the economy because we're so deeply in debt. But every time there's a recession, debtors get relief because rates go down. But if we get a recession where the markets turn up the heat on debtors because we end up with inflation and recession simultaneously. And so bonds don't rally, bonds go down, and then interest rates rise. Imagine how much weaker the next recession is going to be when consumers are faced with rising interest rates, not falling interest rates, and when the cost of living is going up, not, you know, remaining stable. So this is going to be, you know, a disaster of epic proportion. People should be buying physical gold. I mean, obviously, shiftgold.com is the best place to buy it. I mean, and sales have been very weak all over the gold world, which is another great contrarian indicator.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Shopping for fine jewelry just got easier. GoldSeek.com has identified the most successful jewelry brand to launch in recent times. Many Jewelry is rewriting the way consumers buy fine jewelry. Integrity Craftsmanship, the only company to sell 24-karat gold and platinum jewelry, avoiding confusing alloys and gems, a true precious metals investment. Many Jewelry's disruptive business model embraces Franco-American craftsmanship and direct-to-consumer economics, rapidly disrupting the $20 billion monopoly, just like Amazon and Uber. The sky is the limit with $1 billion of jewelry purchases daily for loved ones and those special occasions. Many Jewelry is an innovator positioned to capture market share, with annual sales growth in the industry topping $30 billion by 2021. Many Jewelry coined the term investment jewelry, pricing by the gram, transparently disclosing its profit margins, a truer investment in pure gold or platinum. Similar to real estate, even artwork, Many Jewelry has a weighted value easily calculated, ensuring value wealth as a long-term investment. With sales in 60 countries around the globe, 20,000 orders already, don't miss out on the explosive growth potential. Many Jewelry trades under the symbols MENE on the Toronto Exchange, and in the US, MENEF. Remember to sign up to Many's Shareholder Club to receive shareholder news, updates, and special discount codes for jewelry purchases. Remember, Many Jewelry.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. OneGold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. OneGold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals distributed ledger and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through OneGold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, OneGold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.